And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast, where we take weekly PGA Tour news and relate it to golfers of all skill levels. I'm Tim Briand, Executive Vice President of TruSpec Golf, joined by Jonathan Wall, Managing Editor for Equipment for Golf.com, and Andrew Tursky, Senior Equipment Editor for Golf.com as well. Gentlemen, happy Wednesday.
Timmy B, thanks for having me.
What's going on, man?
I mean, do you really have a choice, Tursky? I mean, you're on this, you're on this regardless, man. You don't have any choice.
That's right.
He forces me into it.
How's things going, guys?
Man, I mean, it feels like there's a lot going on in the gear space right now. I mean, we're going to discuss a lot of the hot topics, but yeah, I mean, thankfully Bryson keeps us busy.
Yep.
I mean, it feels like he's doing something new every at least couple of weeks. So yeah, we got a lot to discuss today.
Sure do. I'm hoping we can get through the season. We've got some news of a couple more players testing positive this week for COVID. But as you know, as far as gear, as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of gear news coming out of all these events just because there's so much change that's been going on throughout the break that they had, and guys are still settling in, so to speak, with some of the gear changes that they've made. So it should be a great episode. We're going to talk about DJ's putter. Obviously, DJ got back in the winner's circle. We saw the TaylorMade Truss for the first time get into the winner's circle this last weekend, which is a cool, innovative design from TaylorMade. And that'll kind of springboards into another conversation about the customization of putters out on tour. And I don't think the average golfer out there understands exactly how customized some of these putters are. We've also got an interesting story regarding Bryson's 2-wood. So he's now using a 2-wood, and we'll dive into that a little bit. We've got a product that just launched from Cleveland, one of the first new products to launch post-coronavirus, Cleveland RTX Zipcord Wedges, the new iteration on the tour wedge for Cleveland. Got a great mailbag question lined up, and then I was able to spend some time with a close personal friend of mine, Tony Ruggiero, who teaches quite a few players out on tour. Really excellent instructor, teaches golfers of all skill levels. But the really cool thing about Tony is that he's probably one of the best player development instructors in the industry. He takes a lot of kids from being junior golfers and turns them into NCAA champions and eventual PGA Tour winners. So it was great to spend some time with Tony. So with that, let's get into our segments for the week. DJ's putter. Truss getting in the winner's circle. Did you guys think that would happen?
I mean, I didn't think, if I'm being honest, I didn't think that it was going to make another appearance in DJ's bag. You know, during the restart at Colonial, he put a truss in the bag. Now, it's different. It's the TM1 was the first one that he put in, and that's more of the winged mallet.
Yeah, the fang mallet.
That's part of the truss line. Yep. And didn't putt well. Next week we see him. He's got a Spider X chalk, and then all of a sudden he's got Truss the TB1, which is the blade version. And I thought for sure, like, here we go, DJ third putter in 3 weeks. I mean, he's done this before, but. But usually it's kind of funny. DJ it's weird when he changes drivers.
He wins, right?
I actually did some digging. When he changes drivers, he actually wins at a pretty high clip that very first week out. He's done it before with the putter. I remember a few years back he put in a TP. I think it was a Juno during the playoffs, and he won. It again. So you're never quite sure with the putter what's going to happen with DJ. But yeah, throws it in the bag and 26 putts in the third round, 61. You know, he was putting lights out. So clearly it's working. We'll see how long it stays in the bag, like most things with DJ.
You can never tell with DJ. I mean, he'll change round to round with putters, not even week to week, just round to round. So, I mean, he could come out next time he plays and have a different putter than the one he just won with. He's the biggest wild card with driver and putter.
You know what we call that? Pulling a Hideki, that's what I like to call it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, listen,
exactly
I remember,
right.
remember the year that Hideki blew the field away at Bridgestone?
Yep.
And he had put in a TaylorMade putter that week. in his next start, very next start, I think it was that next week, he changes putters.
Wild.
He has a new Scotty every week. He brings like 10 of them to every event.
Yeah, he is by far the biggest putter aficionado out on tour. I mean, DJ's usually got three in the bag. I think three is about the average number. Usually it's one blade and a couple of mallets, and that's pretty normal. If DJ has one putter in the bag, something's going on. That's just it's weird for a practice round. But yeah, Hideki, I mean, six, seven putters. I'm not, and that's not us over exaggerating. That's the truth. 6-7 putters in the bag. It's crazy.
We see him. We see DJ and Hideki on the putting greens all the time, and they literally have like 7 or 8 putters laying right next to their little practice area on the putting green. It's actually really funny.
Yeah, keep us in business.
I would say that is contrary to the advice I would give most players, which is find something and stick with it. I do believe there's a bit of a placebo effect with the honeymoon period of getting a new club in the bag. You don't have any of that negative, you know, any negative performance history behind it that would cause doubt and anxiety. Having kind of a fresh new look, maybe a little bit of a different feel, can sometimes give somebody a fresh outlook. And I do understand that. But, you know, when you look at the best putters throughout the PGA Tour, and the vast majority of them don't switch their putters very often. And if they do, they tend to gravitate back to whatever is their old trusty. You know, DJ is kind of as we all know, he's definitely unique. And changing drivers and winning, that's pretty atypical. Changing putters regularly and, you know, winning with new putters in the bag, that's atypical. The one interesting thing about his putters, and if you look at this TM1 truss putter that he won with this last week, you can see that the truss design is a little different from the conventional one.
Describe that, Tim, for people that maybe haven't seen this putter
before. So the regular TM1, if you look at the truss, basically the hosel configuration, it's set up so that the center axis of the shaft runs directly through the face, which by definition is going to make that putter more face balanced. There is a little bit of toe hang in it, I think like 16, 17, 22, 20 degrees.
16 degrees.
And so
in the retail version,
the toe hang of a putter correlates to how we close the face. It correlates to the rate of closure when we're swinging a putter, and then rate of closure obviously correlates to the squareness of the face and whether it's open or closed and what the tendencies are. And typically with more toe hang, you're going to get a face that presents more open at impact. With less toe hang, you're going to get a face that's more closed. When you look at the TM1 truss putter that Dustin had in play, you'll notice that the hosel configuration is not the same as the retail version. It's actually a little bit more heel biased, meaning that the center axis of the shaft runs kind of halfway between the center point of the blade and the heel of the blade, which is going to make that putter act more like a 45 degree toe hang or more like a regular conventional answer to or Scotty Newport 2 or something like that, something that, you know, a lot of listeners are familiar with. So that's kind of a little custom piece that he has in his bag that's designed to give him more toe hang. And when you look at the spider putters and you look at a lot of the putters that he's played throughout his career, they do tend to have a little bit more toe hang, you know, anywhere between 35 degrees up to 60 or 70 degrees. You look at the spider with the little short flow neck, there's a good bit of toe hang there. So, it's a little different than the one you can get at retail, although they're, you know, obviously the core technology in that putter is the idea of adding that truss piece to the hosel, which is supposed to enhance MOI and add stability. And that was one of the things that Bill Price, over at TaylorMade has really been working on. How do we get high MOI into a blade putter? It's very easy to get in a mallet. It's very easy to get in a fanged, high MOI, you know, sort of head design. But high MOI is very difficult to get in a smaller size blade. So that's kind of what they're trying to do with that truss, as we've spoken about before.
This is one of the things that DJ's always struggled with, and I've talked to him about it. It's growing up being an answer-style putter guy,
right,
but realizing that you have more success and you've got the benefits of a mallet. You know, he's really struggled kind of going back and forth because he just loves the look of an answer style blade. And again, understands that there are benefits to be had with a mallet. So this is kind of TaylorMade's answer. And I think it's a great answer for recreational golfers who maybe struggle with some of the same things. You know, DJ rotates the putter face more. You know, when you're talking about a lot of mallets out there, unless you've got a custom one, a lot of mallets are going to be straight back, straight through. So this is kind of your answer to the best of both worlds. You get a little bit of toe hang, 16 degrees in the retail version. You can rotate the face a bit more, but you still get that, you know, mallet forgiveness, stability, whatever you want to call it. So yeah, I think that, you know, DJ's win will give it a little bit of a bump. How much of a bump, I'm not quite sure, but yeah, I think it's a cool design and it's going to probably intrigue some people out there.
I was just going to say the problem with the truss is that it looks like so outlandish from the back, and especially the view that you get on TV, it's like, what am I looking at? But when you actually put it in your hands, you actually can't really tell that there's that pyramid shape, that triangle shape, whatever you want to say. I mean, it's a truss, but you can't really tell from a dress, and I think that's like a barrier to entry for some people who are just seeing it on TV.
I'll take devil's advocate position on that with you, Andrew. When white-headed drivers first came out, we all said, what are they doing? But it actually was really smart from a marketing play, because everybody knew that they had that in play. And so everybody's going to know that you've got a truss in play. So if they do get a player that catches lightning in the bottle and rips off a couple wins using one, everybody's going to know he's using one, and maybe that actually pushes some sales. So this is the perfect segue into the next segment, which is customized putters out on tour. You guys see this all the time. You don't see too many golf shop or retail putters out there. There's usually, and I'm not just talking about length and loft and lie, I'm talking about cut and weld hosels, special alignment, you know, packages, all sorts of stuff that you usually just don't get available as a retail golfer. I'd love to get into that a little bit, because these putters are really cool, actually.
I can, you know, I think if you look at a lot of the tour putters that are out there, you know, Tim mentioned some of the differences. You know, we're talking about, you know, different neck configurations than you might be able to find at retail. You know, I know there are a lot of, and I shouldn't say a lot, but there are some notable golfers that use Odyssey putters that still prefer that original white hot insert. And if you look closely on TV, sometimes you can see some of the newer Odyssey putter heads with an older model white hot insert in it. You know, Scotty Cameron is known for bringing out high-end materials. You know, we talk about the German stainless steel that Tiger has on his putter, and a lot of other tour pros that have used Cameron's in the past, Dustin Johnson, Justin Thomas, Hideki, guys that have used German stainless or surgical stainless steel. So there are some differences. It's just, again, we're talking about elite golfers, and if they want something, typically they're going to get it. You know, I know some recreational golfers don't like that. They don't like that they see a putter. You know, we mentioned Dustin Johnson's truss having a different toe hang than the retail version. You know, I would venture guess to say that the average, you know, mid handicapper, you're still going to benefit from the retail version of that putter, the TB1. Even if you don't have the same DJ toe hang, I think a lot of golfers just want to use what the pros have, and sometimes you just have to realize, you know, you're not that golfer. That those players are looking for something so specific, yep. And that's not to say that a recreational golfer can't discern the difference between, you know, a little bit of toe hang or, you know, changes in a tour version of a golf ball or an insert, but these are things that you really only get if you're at the highest level. It's the same reason why, you know, pro basketball players get player edition shoes, mm-hmm. you know, that never show up. I mean, if you look inside, they've got special inserts and soles. So yeah, it's just, I don't want to say play better, but if you want some of these things, you're going to need to play better, or you're going to need to pony up the money if they ever come to retail. They do eventually, you know, Scotty Cameron, the Circle Tees, when they come out, their first shots out on tour, but if nobody wants them, a lot of those will end up at the gallery. So yeah, play better if you want one of those tours.
I think back to the J-Day original Spider with the slant, little tiny flow neck, or no, that was just a little slant neck. Excuse mm-hmm. me. That was a really small slant neck. And I remember that that was a special cut and weld job that they did just for him. Kiama basically Frankensteined a putter together using two different putters, cutting the neck off of one and welding it to the other one, and then refinishing it, repainting it, making it look great. And that was what J-Day was using when he was, I mean, how well was he putting during that period of time when he first put that thing in the bag? It was amazing. That's when he was winning all of his events. Yeah. And
he was putting so well with that spider that every single person on the PGA Tour switched into a spider.
Exactly.
That's how
good he was putting.
That shows you.
Exactly.
That shows you how big of an influence J-Day had on the rest of the players. You know, I go back to when he won with the spider red. You know, that was a putter. The story behind it, you know, it's a cool marketing story. You know, you always kind of wonder if it's really legit, but it was this redback spider from Australia that had this distinct red color on it. That was the marketing story behind it. But it popped on television. It was a lot like the white driver. And, you know, I actually heard from tour pros that I was talking to about this putter when it was blowing up. And Tursky, I don't know if you remember this, but some of the tour pros, because they saw that there was a black version too, they said, hey, can I get the black version? And the basically kind of what it was brought down from up top at TaylorMade was, you're going to use the red. If you want to use the putter, you're going to use the red because it shows up on television. I mean, it makes total sense. And a lot of guys, even though they might not have chosen the red right off the bat, they ended up picking it. And that's one that definitely it exploded out on tour, and, you know, it exploded at retail. Man, I had so many friends, and I'm sure you guys did as well, that were asking to, you know, where can I pick up a spider?
Yep.
That was the putter that everybody
And it had. Actually influenced other brands' designs, because very shortly thereafter you started to see Odyssey with red heads, and
Odyssey had a very similar red version come out.
So
that same year, I think.
So it's kind of interesting.
They also had a similar design come out to the spider.
Yeah. But the
another topic for another day.
The biggest thing to me on these customizations of putters are the hosel designs and the different weld placements. You know, you start to look at where they're actually inserting the hosel into the head and where that marries up, and you start to see some really cool, you know, unique one-off designs. And as you mentioned, J-Wall, you do see some of these on the secondhand market. Obviously, all of the ones we see on the secondhand market are usually the rejects. Those are the ones that didn't make the cut for whatever reason.
They still look good.
I remember a few...
I'll take any tour rejects.
Remember a few years back, there was a guy that claimed that he had one of Tiger's Cherry Bomb putters and was trying to sell it. It was 10 years ago, I want to think. And somebody checked into it, and it was BS. It wasn't real. But the reason that they were able to figure that out is because there aren't many Cherry Bomb putters out there that were designed, and there aren't many rejects that would fall in line with that. And the ones that were made have really specific specs. And obviously the one that this guy was trying to push out there did not. But, you know, putters is something that I really like to follow, because I see a lot of craftsmanship in what goes on with different putter designers, especially the high-end putter designers like Peretti and Bettinardi and some of the really nice designs and craftsmanship that those different machinists through the different...
Dell,
exactly. So with that, let's get into our third topic for the week, which is Bryson's Tuatara. I didn't hear a lot of information come out regarding this. I think this one kind of slipped under the radar with a lot of people, but J-Wall, I think you've got some insight here.
You got the scoop.
I got the scoop on this one. They apparently even called me out on or gave me a shout out on the live stream, which I didn't hear myself, but thought that was kind of neat. So yeah, you know, there was a little bit of chatter. One of our colleagues over at Golf, Luke Cardenine, was out at Travelers last week, and he slacked myself and Tursky, and he says, I think Bryson's using some kind of a two wood. And my initial reaction is like, and I don't know what you thought, Tercy. I'm like, Luke, you're an instruction guy. I know you love gear, but
stay,
like,
in your lane.
Stay in your lane. Stay in your lane, man. Stay in your lane. Don't tell me that you think he's got a two wood, then when it's probably just the three wood. But lo and behold, he was right. I talked to Ben Showman, who was Cobra's tour rep, and got the scoop. And it's kind of interesting, you know. Bryson, I guess going back to Colonial, he was trying to get some sort of a five wood that was going to go. This is going to sound crazy. Looking for a five wood that was probably going about 270 yards. Bryson's bulked up a ton. He's gained a ton of swing speed, and they kind of came to the realization, they being Ben and the team over at Cobra, that we can't strengthen this five wood anymore as much as we can go without Frankensteining it. We're not going to do that. So he said, what if we just get a 13.5 degree three wood and just make that your quote unquote five wood? And Bryson tried it out and loved it. And this was like right before the first, right around the first round of Colonial. And so now you've got Bryson with his 5.5 degree driver and a 13.5 degree three wood kind of acting as his five wood. You had a pretty big loft gap right there, guys. 5.5 to 13.5. So what do you do?
Yep.
You go and you find a club that can fit in there. Now, there aren't a whole lot of clubs short of adding another driver, doing a fill and going with two drivers to try and fit in that, you know, a 10 or 11 degree slot. So luckily, Cobra had an ace in the hole, which was this F6 prototype that they just kind of put together on a whim, not really quite sure if it would ever pop at retail. But hey, you know how the R&D guys, Tim, you used to work yeah, in R&D. You know how the guys are when it comes to club design. They designed a quote unquote two wood. It was a deeper faced version of the F6 fairway. And it kind of had some you know, driver properties to it, just to see what would happen. It never came to retail. It got stuck in the vault, and lo and behold, Ben goes in and they've got three of these F6 two wood prototypes, 10 degrees aloft, and they build one up, send it to Bryce, and he throws it in the bag. It's his 300 yard club, which, again, when I'm talking about 270 yard five woods. And now he's got a 300-yard two-wood. I mean, this is crazy stuff because, again, Bryson is looking for a club that he can hit accurately but doesn't go 340. So if he's trying to kind of have – it's more of his fairway finder. Again, sounds ridiculous, but it works for Bryson. And it's now in the bag. So he's got a 5.5-degree driver. He's got a 10-degree two-wood and a 13.5-degree five-wood. It's by far one of the most
two-wood a lot,
setups.
Too.
Yeah,
he was actually hitting that thing a lot, and he was hitting it like 300 to 310. It's like, yeah, oh my god, it's actually working.
Do you know?
I know, that's a thing.
So, J-Wall, do you know build spec on those two fairway woods? Do you know how long they are as far as length? Because obviously, we know his build spec is really unique in the irons, but I've never really heard what his build spec is in fairways.
I don't, Tim. That's a really good question. I didn't get build specs on it. The only specs I got on that two wood. Was Bryson typically, I guess, when they build that, or when they built that two wood, it had 20 grams of weight, yeah, in the sole. But for Bryson, you know how this is, he's looking for stability and he's looking for a heavier product. He has 40 grams, 220 gram weights in the sole of that product. So it's a very heavy, but yeah, I didn't get length.
So that
specs.
would tell me that it's shorter. The fact that they put that much head weight in would tell me that, yeah, it's definitely, it has to be, unless they're using some kind of crazy counterbalance shaft. It tells me that that shaft would definitely be shorter than a conventional three wood, around 43 or 43.25 inches. Because otherwise the swing weight would be way too high. You know, like if you're throwing 40 grams of weight, or an extra, in this case, it's an extra 20 grams of weight because the regular one has a 20 gram weight as well. If you put an extra 20 grams of, yeah, weight in there, it's going to make that swing weight go through the roof. But as we've mentioned before, Bryson is not as sensitive to that sort of stuff. He's just looking. He's not the look and feel guy like most of these guys. He just wants stability, and he wants that thing to,
yeah,
perform.
This is, Tim, just to give you specifics on swing weight, the Ben told me that this particular product is kind of in like the mid 225 gram range for head weight. And he said that it went from D8 with his 3-wood to E2.
There you go. How many golfers are playing an E2 3-wood? So
none. I think he's probably the only one. Yeah. So. That's, I mean, you're literally swinging a telephone pole.
So a couple things going on there, right?
And he's hitting it over 300 yards.
He's hitting it over 300 yards. Exactly. Which is just insanity.
So a couple things. The fact that it's E2 tells me that it is probably actually close to standard length. I was making an assumption that they were trying to build to some semblance of a normal swing weight on this thing. And in order to do so, you would have to build it short. But the fact that it's E2 tells me that it is probably close to 43 inches. If not 43, so that's one thing that's really interesting.
That's your fault for assuming Bryson was trying to do something normal.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing in his golf bag is normal. So here's my take on it. Right, the average golfer that's thinking about putting a 2-wood in play, I would say, unless you're extremely fast speed, really really strong, and really really good at hitting the center of the face all the time. Don't do it, because the head size, the sweet spot size on a 2-wood is clearly going to be much smaller than on a driver, which means that your miss hits are going to lose, you know, they're going to be more offline potentially in some cases, but definitely going to lose a lot more distance. That's number one. Number two, playing a 2-wood at 11, 12, 13 degrees aloft, number one, off the turf, it's unusable for most players. They just can't get it airborne. Now, Bryson can get it airborne off the turf because he has the speed. The other thing that would be interesting to know is, where did they put that extra 20 grams of weight? Did they put it towards the face, or did they put it towards the trailing edge along the skirt? If they put it along the trailing edge along the skirt, then that's going to cause the shaft to deflect forward more, which adds loft, which then turns that 10-degree 2-wood into more like a 12 or 13. So that's kind of interesting.
It's pretty standard weighting, Tim. I mean, you remember
yeah,
six.
Of course.
It had the one in the one the weight in the heel.
So they did it through cartridges and not through hot melt and other means, right?
Correct. Right. Yeah. Just cartridges within the head.
So then the CG wouldn't have really changed.
I think there's a ton of head manipulation.
But then the next piece of this too is, how many 3-woods is Bryson going into greens with? I mean, he's hitting at 350, so the hole would have to be 650 yards long in order for him to use a 3-wood to hit it into the green. How many 650-yard par fours do they play out, or par fives out there do they play? To my knowledge, not very many. So what that means is, this 2-wood is basically just a golf club that's being used off of tee boxes, which would make sense in line with the fact that this is a deep face product. And most deep face 3-woods are designed to use off of tee boxes. They're not as great off the fairway, but really good off of a tee. So what we're really talking
about... You'll never see Bryson use this. Yeah. Off the fairway.
Why would he ever need to, you know? He'd hit it, you know, 40 yards over the green on most par fives if he tried to rip it off the fairway. So because his speed has gone up so significantly, and he's now swinging the club, you know, in the realm of what long drivers swing, with these long drivers, you see these astronomically high spin rates, and it's because of speed. They play these crazy low driver lofts, 2, 3, 4 degrees, but because they're swinging at 140 miles an hour, they still generate 3,000 RPMs of spin. Same sort of thing when you're talking 3-wood, is when they generate these obscenely high speeds, they also tend to generate way more spin than they need. So it would make sense, how do you control the spin? Well, you do it multiple different ways, but the easiest way to do it is just change the loft. So makes sense to play a 2-wood off the tee for him. You know, hitting the ball 350 yards is... really, really, really helpful out on the PGA Tour. But there are some holes, some golf courses, that hitting at 350 isn't actually necessarily helpful, especially on certain layouts, because you start having to hit it over corners and the fairways really pinch in, or the fairways are really angled at a funny angle at 350 yards. The interesting statement this week he made about Detroit Golf Club, he said, Sorry, Mr. Ross.
I'm glad you are.
Sorry, Mr. Ross. All your cross bunkers are at 290, and I carry
that
those
was
things.
So funny.
Yeah. It is what it is. You know, that's kind of just his thing now, is a lot of, you know, we talk about, you know, Gus the tiger proofing the golf course after he ran roughshod on it. you know, it's like, what are you going to do now that you got a guy who's even longer than Tiger was during his prime out here hitting missiles? I mean, what can you do? I mean, a lot of these golf courses are helpless, especially when he's, you know, hit the golf ball well off the tee. You know, 290 is nothing for Bryson. He's going to be using that 2-wood all week probably and just flying it over that and keeping it in play. He won't even really need a driver. So, yeah, I'm really interested to see how he attacks Detroit Golf Club this week. We have another full weekend of golf ahead of us, and even though the trophy is reserved for the winner, the big cash prizes don't have to be. To add to the excitement, DraftKings, the leader in daily fantasy sports, is putting you in the center of the action with a free shot at over $1 million in total prizes with your first deposit. It's easy to play. Just pick six golfers, stay under the salary cap, and submit your lineup before the tournament tees off on Thursday. Then sit back and follow the action. The more red numbers they have on the leaderboard, the closer you'll be to winning some green. Rack up points for pars, birdies, finishing position, and more. Even though you may not be able to hit the golf course, DraftKings is giving you the chance to scratch your competitive itch and reign supreme. Download the DraftKings app now and use code FE during signup. This week, DraftKings is putting you in the action with a free shot at over $1 million in total prizes. That's code FE, and you can get a free shot at over $1 million in total prizes only at DraftKings. Minimum $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details.
Anyone who's dealt with erectile dysfunction knows how awkward it can be to talk in person. Luckily, there's a simple, convenient solution to get the treatment you need without leaving the couch. Our friends at Roman have spent years building a digital platform that can connect you with a doctor licensed in your state, all from the comfort of your home. Roman makes it convenient to get the treatment you need right from home. Just grab your phone or computer, complete a free online visit, and you'll hear back from a U.S. licensed physician within 24 hours. And if the doctor decides that treatment is right for you, your medication can be shipped right to your door with free 2-day shipping. You also get free unlimited follow-ups with your doctor anytime you have questions or want to adjust your treatment plan. With Roman, there are no commitments and you can cancel anytime. If you're struggling with ED, stay home and go to GetRoman.com/FE for a free online visit and free 2-day shipping. That's GetRoman.com/FE for a free online visit and free 2-day shipping.
One more topic to get into this week regarding the PGA Tour. Some really cool content coming out on Golf TV. They were able to spend some time, Tiger Woods, in his home workshop. And, you know, his home workshop is as good as our TruSpec build shop as far as the equipment he has in there. It's all top of the line, as you would expect. Really interesting segment they did where he's talking about grinding his own wedges. You guys are familiar with this from being out on tour. How many guys do you see actually throw the gloves on and start grinding their own wedges in the vans? I know Sergio does it.
There's like two.
I know Sergio will get in there.
I think Sergio and Retief. Retief Goosen, I think, does it too.
Charles does it a little bit.
I've seen one other.
Who else?
Who's that?
A Rory, but not the Rory you're thinking about. Sabatini.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, Sabatini. Yeah.
Sabatini. I've seen. I've walked into the truck and seen him grinding his own wedges. It's,
you know who I've never seen. Something. I've never seen Tiger.
Yeah, I and that this kind of surprised me, to be honest. I didn't really think Tiger did a lot of his own work. I thought, you know,
he's worked with the best wedge grinders in the game.
That's what I'm gonna say. He's worked with all these legends who've worked on him.
He's never had a knee.
So is this more of a case where because he's worked in tandem with these legends that he's picked up little tips? You know, Tiger's an inquisitive dude. What are you doing here? What are you doing there? What's that about? Trying to learn. And then he expresses an interest in it and he's like, I want to get into that. Do you think that's more of what's going on here, just a curiosity and an interest, or is he actually learning things from, you know, guys like Mike Taylor and then actually trying to produce different sole configurations just for his own testing purposes, or is this just more curiosity?
Do I think Tiger is grinding wedges for himself to play in competition?
He's not grinding
absolutely,
gamers. No way.
Absolutely
hell
no way.
No.
No, there's absolutely 0% chance. And I think, I think he's seen like Mike Taylor and Vokey and all them do it. And I think he just wants to try it. and he's probably taken old wedges to the grinding wheel to see if he can replicate some sole configurations that he's had in the past, but I don't think Tiger's really grinding his own wedges.
Now, I will say this.
He's grinded wedges, but not his wedges.
I will say this, Tursky. Knowing his level of perfectionism and his level of attention to detail and how he doesn't mess around, I bet you he's pretty good at it. I bet you he may not be at a Mike Taylor quality, but I bet you he's pretty good at it because I don't see him going in there.
But that's,
right, that's the point.
You just said he's not at Mike T's level, right. And so there's no way that he's gonna be messing around with a wedge that's going in his bag. If he's got something that's gonna be used on Sunday, that wedge has been touched by Mike Taylor.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, so. I don't doubt that he's a perfectionist and a fast learner. Like, I'm sure Tiger can be pretty good at grinding a wedge, but Mike Taylor's been doing it literally his whole life.
Yep.
Do I think he's ever gonna be better than Mike Taylor? No.
Is Mike Taylor ever going to be better than Tiger at golf? No. So there you go.
Also, no. No.
That's a hard no.
So
I bet Mike T's wedge game is dirty, though.
I'd love to see it. You know, with all this wedge talk, let's get into a new product on Gear Spotlight this week. Cleveland just dropped a new wedge. Really cool looking product. RTX Zip Cord. Looks like they are really looking at how to make the wedge a little more forgiving. How to put CG more back into the center of the face and not let it get heel biased. Looks like the grooves got a little more aggressive. It seems to be a trend in wedge design to mess around with CG, add some forgiveness, and add some more aggressive configuration to the grooves. We've seen this out of other products from other manufacturers. What do you guys know about Zipcord?
Yeah, this is a cool looking wedge. You know, it looks pretty traditional from the outside. I know. A few people saw the photos and were wondering about the kind of the Zipcord badging that's kind of higher up on the toe. I've seen this wedge in person. It's a little bit raised, but it's not chunky at all. It still looks like your traditional Cleveland wedge. And you know, you think about Cleveland's history within the short game realm. You know, they're one of the best. I mean, before Tiger was a Vokey guy, he used Cleveland wedges when he was in college. So
588. You know,
yeah, 588s, which I mean, I used those wedges. They were great wedges. So again, you know, they have a lot of history. The Rotex, the RTX has been kind of their bread and butter over the years, and they've come out with different iterations of the RTX. But this wedge is different when you look underneath the hood. You know, we've seen some manufacturers. I think about Vokey. You know, they initially with SM. With SM6, they started shifting around weight on the backside of the head. Visually, you could see it, and that was used to change launch. Mm. And, you know, then with the new version, with SM8, they were able to do this from the inside. So visually, it looks like your traditional Vokey wedge now. It's kind of similar to what Cleveland's doing here. They're kind of doing things on the inside, manipulating, moving weight around, to try and kind of shift the CG. So if you were to cut this wedge open down through the hosel, there's a low density material, kind of a low density core, I guess you could call it, in that hosel that allowed them to take out that discretionary weight and reposition it. So, you know, without getting too far into the weeds on the numbers, by shifting that weight, you're going to get the center of gravity is 1.4 millimeters closer to the center. Also moving that weight around, they were able to increase the high low MOI by 9%. Now you typically aren't talking about forgiveness MOI when you're talking about a wedge, but you know, that's what they're doing here is you're going to be able to get more shot consistency when you hit this. So that means, you know, better launch, better spin characteristics. You know, you mentioned the grooves on this, that UltiZip groove is 11% sharper. They actually made this groove configuration tighter. Mm-hmm. So there's two additional grooves, which is going to give you about an extra 7% more groove contact when you're connecting that golf ball with the grooves at impact. So yeah, there is a lot going on with this wedge. Again, you know, just from an internal perspective, I kind of think, and I don't know what you guys would say, but I kind of think that this internal geometry, you know, shifting weight around, doing it like this, I kind of think this is the future. You know, we've seen Vokey do it with SM8. Now we're seeing Cleveland do it with this wedge. I could totally see other manufacturers kind of trying something as well to, you know, get a little bit extra forgiveness. Because look, not everybody's hitting dimes. They're not diming out their wedges.
Yep.
So you got to help them out a little bit.
There's one interesting thing about this wedge design. And in trying to make a sweet spot, you know, more effective and make it more forgiving, when I look at the wedge, I have to, for the average golfer, this is obviously a huge win, because the average golfer needs as much help when it comes to forgiveness as possible, because they don't hit it, definitely don't hit it in the center, and then they also don't repeat where they strike it on the face. For the advanced tour player, though, I don't know if that's a good thing, because, you know, look at Couples' wedge, where he's hitting it out on the toe. He's doing that on purpose. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of research done recently that some of these guys that are excellent wedge players actually do tend to use the toe. Look at Phil using the high toe area of the wedge. Look at the way that players use the face of a wedge. And what they're doing there is they're using the mishit, so to speak. They're intentionally mishitting the shot to be able to positively affect the outcome, meaning they're intentionally mishitting it. Why do you want to hit it high and on the toe of a wedge? That seems crazy, right? Well, the reason is because it deadens the hit. It comes off the face much softer. Well, if you're making a full swing and you have to swing a lot faster because the ball comes off softer, by swinging a lot faster, you're going to actually impart more spin on the shot. And so that's kind of some of the research that's come out, is by striking it out on the toe, they end up basically deadening the blow, so this player has to swing harder to hit it the same distance and spins it more. And there are a lot of players that play around with strike position around the greens and on pitch shots and, you know, even longer range pitch shots. And they use the strike location to alter the performance of the shot and create different spins and trajectories and all sorts of different things. So with wedge design, I do, at the tour player level, I say, you know, if you make the wedge too forgiving, it probably is not as playable. And you want a wedge to be super playable for those guys. For the average golfer, obviously, they need as much forgiveness as possible. I did see this product a couple weeks back. One of our friends from Cleveland stopped by and showed it to us. The product looks beautiful. I noticed right away how aggressive the groove system was. And having hit a few balls in our hitting bay, that thing chews. And it chews hard. So anybody out there that's trying to get a little extra spin on some of their wedge shots, I know that Jay Wall and I had done some work with MD5 from Callaway, and we were really impressed at the way that groove system worked. This new Cleveland wedge will be just as aggressive, and it'll be a spin monster for sure. So really cool product to work with, and I'm looking forward to getting it in some players' hands and see how it performs in the real world. With that, let's get into our mailbag for the week. What do we have in mailbag, Jay Wall?
First question here is one that we typically don't talk about on this podcast, but I think it's a topic that's worth discussing. Somebody said that their nephew is just getting into golf, and this is Chandar on Instagram, who was cool enough to reach out to us, and he knows nothing about junior golf. Do junior clubs get improved tech, or is buying used okay? Thanks, love the pod. So, you know, this is an interesting one, Tim, because, you know, I mean, junior clubs, there's not a ton of junior club product out there on the market. I know a lot of the major manufacturers are doing a really cool job with the junior clubs. Ping,
Prodigy,
in particular, I know if you get a set of junior clubs, they will give you one free opportunity to send them in and get them refit.
Yep.
As you grow, which I think is huge. Yeah, it's a great idea, and a lot of their tech is the same tech that you're going to be getting in the, you know, the adult product. So
yep,
it's not going to be more game improvement than you know, just because you're a junior golfer, you're not going to be getting more forgiveness in your driver than the average,
right,
you know,
adult male. The kids clubs are still conforming, so it's not like you're going to get a 0.9 COR driver and you're going to get some of this other crazy stuff when you get into the world of non-conforming golf clubs. You mentioned Ping. You know, I look at what Ping's done in the junior golf space, and they really kind of led the charge through a lot of OEMs, because they realized – and you see this with Ping. Did neither of you guys played Ping growing up, did you?
I did.
Did you?
Clubs. What? But not through the bag.
All right, so it wasn't through the bag. Anybody that grows up as a Ping player, especially in the irons, playing a set of irons as a junior golfer, and they play that set of Pings for a while through their junior golf experience, they'll probably stay in Pings for the rest of their golfing life. And it's not that they won't try from other brands, they will, but they always gravitate back to Ping. And Ping was one of the first OEMs that said, wait a minute, if we get our products in the hands of junior golfers and these golfers develop around our brand and specifically around some of the tech that's associated with our brand, they're going to get kind of locked in, not just from a brand affinity standpoint where they really like the brand and want to support it, but from a performance standpoint, they actually develop around these clubs and get to a point where they can't play as well with any other type of brand because of the different design concepts. You know, Ping's a little more outside the box with some of their design concepts, I would say. And they've always focused on forgiveness and stability. Other manufacturers, they may chase speed, spin, ball flights. The one thing that every single product that Ping designs, it has to check that box of being very forgiving. Even with the Blueprint iron, you know, as low an MOI as it is, that was still one of the design criteria for the Blueprint, is try to design something in a small package, but still offered some of the Ping forgiveness that people are used to. So Ping was one of the first. And then we started to see, well, before Ping really got into it with the design of Prodigy, U.S. Kids, you know. And we've seen other junior golf manufacturers that specify in junior golf come to market. I would say this as far as the question. If your player is under 5 foot tall, if they are not a teenager, and if they can fit into U.S. Kids clubs or some competitor to U.S. Kids clubs, it makes more sense to go that route when they're starting out, because those shafts, grips, and heads are all at the proper weights to be proportional for that size of a person, being that the kid is so small. You probably don't want to just cut down adult clubs because of the different weighting and all the different features that go into that. One story I always go back to on this topic is John Daly. John Daly used adult clubs when he was starting out as a little kid. And it's no wonder why his backswing is so long. He was trying to use an adult men's driver that was so heavy and so long, he had to wrap it around his neck in order for it to work. He couldn't control the club. And the interesting take on this is that what a player uses in their formative years, especially as a junior golfer, will affect their development as a player, not just as far as their patterns and the way they swing, but it could actually also impact physiologically the way they develop. You look at John's, you know, his radial deviation, which is the way that the wrist kind of moves this way, so to speak. And he can take his wrist and bend it back on his forearm almost like that. And he's got this hyper flexibility that nobody else has. It's no wonder why he creates such a long backswing. So the question is part of the reason he has all that mobility, was that because he was using golf clubs that were really long and really heavy for him when he was a kid and his joints actually started to adjust around it? Interesting conversation. But what I would say is when you get to that last stage of U.S. Kids golf sets, so they have those progressive sets that build into adult sets, that last U.S. Kids set, so to speak, is really going to be very close to what a ladies set is going to be. So I say that the transition coming out of U.S. Kids is usually into a ladies set. And then that gets played for a couple years and then gets reshafted into a little bit heavier, stiffer shaft. And then once that player gets to 13, 14 years old, it's time for some regular adult golf clubs. Obviously, they need to be fit for weight and flex as far as the shaft and as far as length. But that's the point where you transition into regular adult heads, so to speak. So hopefully that answers the question out there. And with that, let's get into our interview for the week. I had a chance to spend some time with Tony Ruggiero. Tony Ruggiero is an instructor out of Alabama. He's taken the director of instruction position at Frederica. Have either of you guys ever been to Frederica or heard about it?
I have heard about it, never been there.
It's a pretty never special been. Spot, man. It's pretty special. The atmosphere that Tony's building there with a lot of tour player clients, a lot of guys, as you may know, a lot of tour players that may not be clients of Tony's, they hang out and practice there. The Big Cat was just out there last week.
So Tiger was there.
That's right. So they're building a really cool thing there. And Tony, as I mentioned at the top of the pod, he's really good at player development. Really close friend of mine. With that, let's get into the interview. And ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome a close personal friend to the podcast, Tony Ruggiero, Director of Instruction for the Frederica Performance Center. Tony Ruggiero, thanks for coming on the pod.
Absolutely. Been looking forward to this. I know we've tried to put it together for a while, but all our schedules finally aligned like the stars aligning. But I told somebody the other day, I tried to hire you years back. You know, when we were putting a learning center to get in down in Bay Point, seems like a long time ago.
It was a long time ago, man.
Called me and you said, "Hey, I thought we had you, and you had the opportunity to go with TruSpec." And I remember saying, "If you don't go to Doral, it was Doral at that time with TruSpec, you're nuts."
Yeah.
And so, first of all, just want to say, always known you're one of the great fitters and teachers in the game. We've done a lot of stuff over the years from Birmingham and Greystone all the way to you being at TruSpec. So congratulations on all your success, and it doesn't surprise me in one least. Just a little pissed I couldn't get you signed up to work for us.
Shoot, man. I'm just trying to be as good as you are, Dew Sweeper. So for those that are listening that may not be familiar with Tony, Tony teaches quite a few really, really good players out on tour. And the topic for today that we're going to kind of discuss with Tony is player development as it relates to equipment. You know, there's really nobody better to speak to. You know, Tony, you've got this stable of tour players, but unlike a lot of teachers, you really cultivate and develop these guys when they're younger. And, you know, if you can get into a little bit about that background and player development and some of your tour players out there, I think it would help our listeners understand your perspective and point of view.
Yeah, you know, I don't think, Tim, I ever went into this thing thinking I was going to coach tour players. We have some mutual background together, you know, so I was mentored and worked forever under Hank Johnson and was his assistant for, he would probably say too long, right? Hank gave me an unbelievable foundation and base to build off of. And I always enjoyed developing junior players and developing players. And along the way, I guess I got okay at it. And so had some good folks come through, Bobby Wyatt and Robbie Shelton and a whole bunch of others. But those were the first two real notable ones. Both play on the Walker Cup. Both became the number one junior player. And so watching them and their progression, there's been others along the way, Smiley Kaufman from college to the PGA Tour, watching him win on the PGA Tour and play in the Masters. And then recently, you know, I would say Andy Ogletree, I've taught him since before college and through his career at Georgia Tech. And then he wins the U.S. Amateur. He's playing PGA Tour events now as an amateur because he wants to play in the Masters in November before turning professional. So, developing young players is my passion. Through the course of that success, I've had the opportunity to be around and be introduced to other players at different stages of their career. And so it's been challenging, but fun, rewarding. And now to me, that adds to what I'm able to offer young players is to mix in these veteran players like Lucas Glover and Bill Haas around guys that are at the beginning of their careers. And so it's interesting. It's fun, challenging. I think like most folks that get to certain levels in their career, you don't start out to do that. You start out because you love something, right? And have an idea about how to do it, and it works out. Certainly a good bit of luck along the way.
Yeah, it's really special what you're building there in Frederica as Director of Instruction, between the tour player vibe and just the facility. Really cool spot, and really excited for you as you get to grow that and build that. But let's dig in a little bit more on gear. You know, obviously fully equipped, the main purpose of what we try to do is to take PGA Tour equipment stories and relate it to golfers of all skill levels, right? We get so much information regarding equipment that tour players are playing, but how does that apply to Joe Brown, the 18 handicap? Well, as you and I know, there's probably not a lot of parallel there. So, you know, one thing that I would love to hear from you on the player development side for lower skilled players, are there any gear hacks that you've kind of figured out along the way to help a more beginner or less skilled player kind of figure out how to get the gear to help them better outside of getting fit?
I mean, so the things and I learned this early in my career, like the things I always do with a student, like we're talking about a golfer that isn't a tour player, right? And I always look in the bag at their wedges. That's always the first thing I look at. And it never shocks me at how many times you see a player with a 54 and a 56 degree wedge.
It's wild, isn't it? It's
unbelievable, right? And you're like, hey, what do you do with that? Oh, this one's my sand, and then I use the other one for this. I was like, you know, they both can do the same thing.
And then the other thing that's crazy there is that if you actually put them on a loft and lie machine, you realize the 54 is at 55 and the 56 is at 55. And you're like, dude, you've got the same loft. What's going on here?
And so, you know, over the years, as we've known, it's like I've had a great relationship with Schrixon and Cleveland Golf. And so that's probably, you know, I learned a little more about the wedges. But like, it doesn't matter to me what manufacturer. I just like, yeah, I look at golfers, I look at their wedges, because I think, look, somebody that's an 85 shooter trying to break 80, right? They're not going to hit 14 greens around. They're going to have more chip and pitching opportunities. So if we can put wedges in their golf bag,
right,
that they can use, that are easier for them to hit, and that can help them get up and down a few more times, I mean, I think we got a chance to lower their scores. And yet, like, to me, you tie this into the PGA Tour. Like, when a tour player changes wedges, it's a huge deal, right?
Yeah.
And they spend an enormous amount of time making sure the grind and the bounce and the look and all of this is exactly the way they want. And yet, the a 15 handicapper just walks into a retail store, grabs a wedge off the rack with plastic on it, and goes and puts it in their bag with no thought. So, that's one place I always start.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Just the scoring clubs in general. You know, it's sexy to hit drives long and straight, but that's not where you put, you know, scores on a scorecard. It's around the greens and on the green. And it's amazing to me. We harp on this week after week with Fully Equipped that just getting your irons or your driver fit is leaving a huge part of this, the equation, you know, it's leaving a huge part of this out. So I couldn't agree with you more. In line with that, you know, when we're talking about beginners and lower skilled players, in addition to the wedges, what else would you say is one of the more common mistakes you see golfers making, you know, over a 10 handicap?
I mean, you know, there's a couple places. And well, one is, you know, at the top of the set, I see too many 12, 14, 15, 20 handicappers with three irons in their golf bags, right?
Like, right.
Where they could go to a six iron and put a good hybrid in there, that would be way easier to hit and give them more benefit.
So why do you think that is, Tony? Is that just ego getting in the way?
And I think a lack of understanding, you know, of what some of this equipment can do. And you were the first person I ever heard use the term agnostic fitting. Okay.
Yep.
And I'll admit, like, I've stolen a bunch of your stuff. Okay. I use it all the time. And so the place that I used to be, the club I was at, it drove me nuts, right? Because they would have a demo day from the same manufacturer every week, right?
Yeah.
And a couple, you know, whatever. And they're trying to get everybody to buy the same 14 clubs of this. And I'm like, and I remember when you and I were talking about it, when I'm like, what are the odds? Right. And then you look on tour and I mean, I know there's guys under contract and they got an X number of clubs, but I can't think of anybody that has one brand all the way through their bag. There's some ping guys would be probably the exception.
Right.
Yeah. For the guys that are not under contract and even some of the guys that are on 14 club deals, it's not unusual to have one sneak in the bag that isn't one of those, you know, on the brand. But
why would a club level golfer who is not getting paid anything to play anything, right?
Great point right there.
Why wouldn't they go find the 14 clubs that perform the best? I mean, I don't get that, right? And
it's wild.
Nobody can do that, go and do, a really good teacher and fitter. And I think fitting's part of the development program. I think access to that is a huge part of developing any player.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, a really important point to make, which is why I think you and I have worked together so well throughout the years, is we understand the synergy between club fitting and instruction and that the two are basically married. And talk to me a little bit about the idea of fitting to a player's flaw, meaning just fitting them to the swing they bring the day of their fitting, versus fitting to their potential when you're talking about, you know, what they're working on in instruction and how important it is to make sure that the instructor is integrated into that process.
But now you're getting to my pet peeve. So, I mean, and that goes back to like these demo days, right? Like, I hate anybody with zero training or and a little bit of knowledge could make a ball on a track man on a range curve a little bit better the right direction, right?
Yep.
I mean, it's not that hard, okay? But how many people can go do it on the golf course and it actually performs
right? Better?
So I've just always believed that you want to fit the golf club to the player and what they're trying to do in their golf swing to improve, so that if they make a better swing, whatever it is that we're asking them to do, they're going to hit a better shot. Whereas yep. if you don't and you go the other way, the player could make a better fundamental golf swing and hit a worse shot. So there's yeah. no – I mean, hell, there's no benefit to getting better with your swing mechanics. And that's why I think it's critical if you're really wanting to get better. I mean, and you want to enjoy the game and you want to go from shooting 90 to 78 or whatever. Take the time to get fit, but you want the person that fits you to understand what you're working on in your golf swing, because yep. because those numbers are different, right? And I just think that so that's why I'm so opposed, and I get obviously I'm Italian, so I get, you know, fired up and all
little
that.
Fired up sometimes.
Oh, I can. You've heard me go off, and but it's ridiculous, right? There's Chip Shot, my dog, going
there. There he is.
The UPS truck. But Chip Shot, call down. But
love it.
Anyways, you know. So I think like that, what you just brought up, that's, it's critical if people want to get better, and right. and it takes training though, and it takes,
and it's different
between fitters and teachers.
And it's different for every player, right? I mean, if you're dealing with a junior golfer who's very athletically skilled and going through lesson curriculums and taking weekly lessons, you know, as a fitter, we have to plan for the future, because not only are we going to get growth, but we're going to get improvement and everything that goes along with this. If you're dealing with somebody that's, you know, past 50, slowing down in speed, maybe they're taking lessons, but they do it once or twice a month. Maybe they're not working on their game. You know, how much are they going to move the needle with instruction? Well, sure, they're going to improve, and they'll probably improve a good bit if they work on it. But are they going to radically change their pattern like a 13-year-old that's learning how to play? Well, I don't see a lot of that, do you?
No, but like, so I'm going to use an example of a gentleman that we had, I guess it was a week ago. And so, you know, he's probably not going to improve. I mean, he's not going to gain a ton of speed, right?
Right.
You know, he's in his 60s. But if you just looked at the TrackMan and his numbers, like they wanted to put him in an 8.5-degree driver, 9-degree driver, right?
Yeah, it's wild.
Right? And I'm like, well, like this guy has no pivot turning through. And so he hangs back, so he adds off. But is he going to go up 10 miles an hour or whatever, or, you know, and hit it 25 yards further? No. But we get put him in 10.5 to where he's got to turn forward, right? Or 10 yeah. degrees where he's got to turn forward. That driver made him have to turn more through, and it made him hit the ball better. Like,
yep.
And so I don't think that just because you're 50, you're 60, I mean, that we can't fit you for a club that makes you make a better golf swing. And I've never bought that stuff of like, oh, well, you get to a certain point, I mean, we just going to put you in something that makes you get better. I mean, who isn't trying to get better all the time if you're playing this game?
Two more questions along the instruction line, and then I want to get into a little tour content before we wrap up. You hear this comment all the time, especially from the higher handicap players. I'm not good enough, or my golf swing does not repeat enough to justify a club fitting. What would you say to the idea that an 18, 20, 25 handicapper's golf swing is not repetitive or consistent?
I think those are the folks that need it the most. I mean, a tour player, I mean, heck, we've all heard this the story of Fred Couples and that ladies five wood or whatever, that, you know.
Yeah, ladies three wood that he was using when he was number one in the world. Wild.
You could give a tour player any club, and if they're so talented and their timing's so good, you gave them a 10 balls, they could figure out how to curve it at the target.
Yep.
And so while they want to be expertly fit because they're playing for their livelihood and their legacy and all that stuff, like, to me, it's even more critical for the club level player, the 15 handicapper, to be fit more precisely, because they're not as talented. They are right. not as athletic. They can't figure out how to line the face up as good. I think they need it more.
So I agree with you, because what I see a lot out of tour players, I had this conversation just 2 weeks ago with Charlie Hoffman. We put down a 3-wood for him to hit a couple times. You know, he works with the guys over at Titleist, I believe, and he just wanted to take a look at an option on a shaft that we had out there. And he put the head down and he said, "Man, this looks open." And then he immediately hooks it. And then he puts down a different club iteration and says, "Man, this looks closed." And then he fades it. And then he turns around to me and he says, "How come I always fade hook-faced clubs and hook open-faced clubs?" And I said, "That's because you're fixing it. It doesn't look right to you, and you're fixing it dynamically during your golf swing, and you're overcorrecting, you're oversteering." I said, whereas the average player, they can't make that correction. They're not that good. So kind of interesting. So with talking about the tour here, I got to ask, with so much time, you've been, you know, making the rounds out there for a few years with your players, and I know, you know, your belief in the equipment making a difference. I have to imagine that you've been involved in some situations with players where you just scratched your head and said, "What are you doing with your gear, man?" We can leave the names out of this, but you got to share a couple nuggets here.
I mean, I've had a player where they put clubs with the wrong shafts in and didn't tell him. And I've had a meeting with the company. I mean, because that affects everybody, right? It affects the caddy. Like, "Hey, what the heck? Like, you didn't tell them." You know, I've had that happen. I've seen, you know, that's the big one, right? I mean, that was the biggest one I saw.
Sneaking products in the bag. I think that's the biggest one there, too.
Yeah, and I've seen players try stuff on the range that they have to try, purposely not hit it good because they're super happy with what they have and don't want to change, right? Purposely.
Seen that too.
Right? All the time. I mean, not all the time. It happens, right? Those are the two big ones. Those are the two big ones that I see. And, you know, I think at times, like with all the technology, if you've been out there like you have, where you've watched a bunch of golf and you've watched a bunch and you've taught a bunch of players, I think common sense can help fit some of these guys better than getting crazy, extravagant ideas.
I would agree with that. Some fitters try to reinvent the wheel, keep it simple, stupid, right? It's something that you and I have made a profession at. You know, a lot of people get pretty complicated. I would qualify myself as a more old school caliber fitter that obviously understands a lot about tech. I would probably put you in the bucket. And I think a lot of that comes from coming out of the same coaching tree with Mark Wood and Hank Johnson and all those guys, where we have some more, I would say, more classical ideas as far as the approach to the swing and instruction. So with that, how do folks find you, Tony, if they're looking to find out more about Dew Sweeper and Fredrika and all that good stuff?
The easiest thing to do probably is social media. You can go, I'm the Dew Sweeper on Instagram. And we always put up a ton of videos of golf swings. You're not going to find a lot of technical junk in there. You're going to have some good rock and roll music in the background.
And I love it.
And you're going to have, you'll have some good golf swings and some fun. Or you can go on Twitter at Dew Sweeper Golf, or you can always go to dewsweepersgolf.com and find out more. But, you know, if you're wanting to get better, have fun, reach out, find us, and come see us at Fredrika. And as I leave this, I want to say, like, the cool thing, as you know, is you don't often find places that have the same long-term vision as you of what's good. And Jim and Bob, the owners at Fredrika, have embraced the vision of creating a special place where you can where we can really develop talent and develop players. And it's a fun thing to be part of, and I'm excited to be there.
Tony Ruggiero, I can't thank you enough, my man. We need to do this more often. I need to come see you here eventually. It's been too long since we've been in a room together having a brew, so we need to make that happen soon enough.
Yeah, thanks for all the support over the years, bud.
Thank you, buddy. Talk to you soon.
And thanks again to Tony for the time. You know, guys, this is episode 49. 50 is going to be a big one, so I figure, you know what we should do? Let's have a giveaway.
Love it.
And because give it's, something because to the it's people. Episode 50, all right? Because it is episode 50, we're going big this time. So thanks to our friends at Cleveland, they have offered up three, not one, not two, but three sets of the new RTX Zipcore wedges. So you're not just going to get one wedge, you're going to get a full set out of them. And we're going to do this giveaway. We're going to announce the giveaway on social on Monday. You're going to get all the details, and then we will announce the winners on episode 50 for the pod. So make sure that you check out our social media channels for all the details. We're at Fully Equipped Golf on Instagram and at Fully_Equipped on Twitter. Thanks as always for listening. We'll see you next week.